Hello and welcome to the Veterinary Secrets Podcast. My name is Dr. Andrew Jones, and this is episode 14. In today's episode, I'm going to be talking about anesthesia and your pets, your dogs and your cat. In particular, the specifics about having a proper pre-anesthetic exam, what you need to know about the differences with anesthesia based on the species of your dog or your cat, based on the age of your animal, based on underlying conditions. In specifics, I'm going to talk about safe and probably more effective anesthetic protocols. I'm going to give you an example of some of my suggested anesthetic protocols. Then lastly, talk a little bit about how you can be more involved anytime your dog or cat needs surgery and questions that you can ask. And then I'm going to talk about a wonderful new movie called Give Me Shelter. It's raising awareness and funds for animal welfare, and one which I encourage you all to support. And then I'm going to discuss the question I had from one of my readers about an injectable antibiotic called Convenia and some of the side effects. Now Veterinary Secrets is on iTunes. You can go to iTunes and search for Veterinary Secrets, or also on Stitcher. You can download the Stitcher app and search for Veterinary Secrets, or go to stitcher.com/podcast/veterinary-secret. I would definitely appreciate it if you would subscribe to my podcast and leave a review. You can do so on iTunes or Stitcher. Questions or comments, feel free to post a comment on my blog at veterinarysecrets.com/blog, or you can send me an email, and that's at podcast@veterinarysecrets.com. Now thanks, let's get right into today's podcast. So is your dog or cat safe under anesthesia? Is that a provocative question? Yes, but important, timely, and one that many pet parents really worry about? Of course, yes again. You know, while I was in veterinary school, I received very little training and time being allocated to anesthesia. You know, there's so much that we need to learn as veterinarians, and much of the real training and application of anesthesia and surgery comes after you graduate from veterinary school. Then in practice, and that was my direct experience, and I think for many other veterinarians, I found that much of the anesthesia, the monitoring, the recovery of your pets after surgery is left to the lay staff. Some staff have specific training, you know, they're such as those being animal health technicians, while others do not. Fortunately, in most cases, things turn out fine. And to be transparent, you know, there has been some quite big advances in veterinary anesthesia knowledge, along with the monitoring and expectations by you as pet parents about how your dogs and cats are going to be cared for. There are huge variations within veterinary practice. And no question, you know, I experienced that throughout. I mean, I work in a number of different veterinary practices prior to owning my own veterinary clinic, and I had some clinics that were very current. You know, they would update their anesthetic protocols, were very concerned about that we examined every animal prior to surgery. We carefully monitored them prior, before, and after surgery. Other clinic, they did the same old anesthesia that they'd done when they first started practice 20 years prior. The old types of anesthesia, very resistant to change. We're there to save money, so they have very little monitoring. You know, we didn't really do much in terms of pre-anesthetic exams, very little monitoring during surgery and after. So this huge range, and it's really difficult for you to know as a pet owner. I mean, you're bringing your dogs, your cats to these clinics, hoping that they're going to sort of be this standard of care that you expect, but there is a huge, huge range. So a big part of this podcast is informing you so you can have higher expectations, and you can just even ask your clinic questions. So here are some things or points I want you to take in, and I hope that you apply. So what do you, as a concerned pet parent, what you need to do is being asking specific questions, and here are some. Number one, who performs the anesthesia at this practice? Never withhold water. If the clinic suggests this prior to surgery, then you should go elsewhere. Food should be withheld for a maximum of 12 hours, and that's only if your pet is over 4 months of age. For young pets, hypoglycemia or low blood sugar is a big concern, so they should have food only withheld for a maximum of four hours, and then offered food prior to surgery. There's a bit of a debate now going on with the amount of fasting time that is necessary. For sure, the maximum should be 12 hours. Many clinics now, or if we're dealing with cats in particular, are saying at the very least wait until midnight before you withhold food. A few different, you know, cat specialists are suggesting that there's no fasting time needed for cats. There's a bit of a range period, and in truth, there hasn't been a pile of studies supporting the specifics. What we've done is draw parallels in human medicine and human anesthesia and surgery and take those to animals. No question, there's a whole big range. And I think to be on the sort of safest part is, one, you don't want to go any longer than 12 hours. The younger your animal, the higher risk of low blood sugar during surgery, which is another huge cause for concern. So they should have minimal fasting time. And in my sense, you know, if I've got a young cat, a very old cat, I would at least offer them a little bit of canned food up until midnight. And if they're not going to be doing that surgery first thing in the morning, your cat could be there. In some cases, they might be there for 4 or 5 hours before they even have surgery. Then you want to be clear when you drop your cat off. And then that clinic, you know, they should be clear with you. So then one of the options would be that, one, you know, they offer your cat a little bit of easily digestible, you know, canned food, you know, such as the Hill's AD or something. So they have some sort of form of nutrition, so they're not going to experience low blood sugar. And secondly, the physical exam. The fact that your dog or cat is to be given a pre-surgical physical exam, ask, you know, what do they use for monitoring? You know, expect that your dog or cat's blood pressure is to be monitored. They use a thing called a pulse oximeter, which measures oxygen saturation. And they use an anesthesia recording sheet as part of surgery. Ask, does your clinic, do they perform a pre-anesthetic check? It's one that I advise. Remember that monitors don't tell you everything. Your pet needs to be checked for body temperature, that they have adequate blood pressure, and that they don't have any changes within their heart, no cardiac arrhythmias. Keep warm. Ensure that your practice is using IV fluid warmers, safe heating pad, warmed up saline, flushing body cavities. Really imperative throughout anesthesia that your dog or cat's body temperature does not allow to drop. Makes a huge difference for safety of anesthesia recovery time. You want to make sure that you're using great pain control during surgery, you know, such as ketamine in the IV bag, especially if we're dealing with these very painful surgeries, such as a knee surgery, or using a narcotic as part of the pre-medication. If adequate pain control is used, then your dog or cat may even require a lower concentration of inhalant anesthetic, making the procedure safe. Pre-oxygenate. If your dog or cat is old, they have a compromised heart, lungs, or organs, then by giving them 100% oxygen prior to being intubated, this ensures that they will not go for a long period of time without adequate oxygen, making the procedure safer. You want to make sure, obviously, but reinstill the point that there's great monitoring after surgery, not just during surgery, but after the surgery. The procedure is not finished until your pet can comfortably breathe on his or her own in the recovery cage. An example of this is a condition called laryngospasm. It's very common in cats. And what's happened is their larynx, that part of their airway, closes in on it. They can have difficulty breathing after that tube. It's called that endotracheal tube. That's the breathing tube has been removed. This can be treated, but someone needs to be there watching your cat after they've recovered from anesthesia. Attaching the monitoring equipment prior to induction of anesthesia, your pet may have low blood pressure or be low in oxygen. And knowing this ahead of time allows the practice to either delay or adjust the anesthesia. The choice of the anesthesia. Ask your clinic what they're going to be using for the first part of the anesthesia, that's called the pre-medication, the induction of anesthesia with the IV injectable. You know, is that ketamine, Valium? Is that propofol, Flaxin? Like, what are they using? Then what type of gas anesthetic they're using to maintain anesthesia? And expect that your dog or cat is on IV fluid. So what is an example of a safe anesthetic protocol for your dog or cat? You'd be looking at a pre-anesthetic, hydromorphone, acepromazine, or hydromorphone alone for older or these debilitated patients. An induction anesthetic could include ketamine and Valium for healthy, uncompromised patients, propofol or aflaxin for older, compromised patients. Aflaxin, it's a new injectable anesthesia with less chance of your pet not breathing, also known as apnea, while being given. Regardless, the key is to give lower calculated percent of the drug initially, such as 25%, to avoid this period of apnea where they don't breathe. And then for maintenance anesthesia, you want to use a gas anesthesia, ideally isoflurane with intubation. Then the following is a pre-anesthetic checklist that your practice should use. And this is courtesy of VASG at VASG.org. That's a veterinary anesthesia support group. First, it's recommended that a veterinarian or licensed veterinary technician supervise patients during admission. You want a properly trained professional being capable of handling this process to make sure everything is done correctly and that the medical record is reviewed properly for completeness. Ideally, we're then following a pre-surgical review of your dog or cat's history to be performed prior to admission. An example here, you want to have food withheld for an appropriate period of time. So for these really healthy dog or cat, especially a big healthy dog, you know, at least we know that they've had withheld food for at least overnight. For the younger animals, the animals of concern, and especially if we're dealing with these small puppies and kittens, we want to make sure that's no more than 4 hours. 4 hours withholding food. And so, as I said, ideal withholding for only 4 hours prior to anesthesia, minimizing the concern of hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. Offering food 2 to 3 hours after recovery. We want to know some of the medications given in the prior week or the prior 7 days prior to surgery. Discussing any new health concerns, and highlighting any previous anesthetic problems, and then any other specifics that we should know. You know, such as dogs or cats that are excessively stressed when kenneled, chewing at their stitches. Lastly, be aware that water has not been withheld prior to admission. Next, we want to make sure that you identify, if we're looking at taking off lumps or bumps, just identify those, you know, circle those with the markers. So you're pointing those out to the staff. In some cases, just clipping them. It's a huge, big benefit being really clear. We want to make sure then, secondly, you're given an accurate estimate and have a surgical release form signed so it's reviewed properly. You're aware of the risks. At the same time, you're aware of then is what's next happening with your dog. It's beneficial for everybody. So we're all clear ahead of time. You're clear. You even know what type of anesthesia your dog or cat is going to get. As far as a pre-anesthetic routine, one, we want to look at a current weight being obtained initially, that within the clinic itself, they have an immediate access to emergency drug reference sheet. And many computer systems don't have that, or your clinic can print that off from the AHA library. An anesthetic record should be prepared for each patient. Next, there should be a proper pre-anesthetic physical exam on every dog or cat prior to surgery. In practice, I did that. This as a veterinarian, in some clinics will pass that off to a very skilled AHT. Regardless, that it's done for every pet prior to surgery. And then from there, we want to categorize the patient based upon certain guidelines. You know, are they an excellent anesthetic choice? They have no serious disease, underlying illness, healthy. You know, such as a healthy 3-year-old dog who's in for a spay or a neuter. But then there's different criteria. Good. Such as an animal, you know, with a mild systemic disturbance, which may or may not be associated with the planned procedure. Maybe they've got a sore leg, or maybe an animal who's slightly overweight, a little bit older. Then fair, an animal with moderate systemic disturbance, which may or may not be associated with the planned procedure. An example here would be a dog, for instance, with a grade 1 or grade 2 heart mitral valve insufficiency, say a mild heart murmur, moderately anemia. And then they get more serious, such as poor, an animal with extreme systemic disturbances, which are incapacitating and are a constant threat to life, you know, such as advanced heart disease, severe pneumothorax, or critical. They've come in urgent or emergent, you know, such as trauma from a car accident. The next part of this anesthesia is then the choice of pre-anesthetic medications and IV fluids. These should be discussed, obviously, first with the staff veterinarian. And the point of these is, one, to provide an experience that minimizes the stress for your pet, anxiety, and minimizes discomfort. But only does it make their stay more pleasant, it's an important part, the pain control process, the analgesia. So that's when I talked about something such as you want to take into certain considerations, such as is there a dog or cat, the size, the age, attitude, health status. But typically, I talked about a couple different ones, you know, such as azepromazine, which is a fairly broad sedative, very safe for dogs and cats. And then some sort of narcotic is hydromorphone. We may or may not use some type of anticholinergic if we're worried about maintaining the heart rate, such as atropine. Then you're going to take into account other, you know, factors based on the age, etc., and risk factors associated with your dog or cat. And then you want the clinic to be looking at, one, that they're going to be giving that anesthesia, that pre-anesthesia, 30 to 45 minutes prior to the induction of anesthesia. If it's just given under the skin, sometimes they'll give it in the muscle. In most cases, we always did the physical exam and then gave the pre-medication, the pre-anesthesia under the skin, and it was always 30 to 45 minutes prior to surgery. And then ideally during that time, you want to wait for it to have some effect before you're placing then an IV catheter. Sometimes you don't have that time, or different things happen in the clinic. They can't always run the way you want it to. We want to make sure, one, all syringes are labeled with their contents. Use stickers if possible. You know, consider tape and a marker if you need to. Just being really clear. You're going to make sure you have a secure IV catheter in place. And due to the fractious nature of some patients, it may be necessary to place the catheter immediately after anesthetic induction. So in some animals, you can't do it. In most cases, it can. And then for general perioperative fluid support, there's different rates you want to run the IV fluids at. So 5 mils per pound per hour, but 10 mils per kilo per hour is the suggested starting point, as an example. IV fluid should be administered through an infusion pump whenever possible. And this is especially important for very small patients, you know, little puppies or kittens, and our cardiac patients for whom fluid overload is a much more likely complication. And if an infusion pump is not available, there's a size of a drip set. They can use something called a micro drip set to be used when administering fluid to patients under 15 pounds. Have the clinic make sure they're dating all the fluid bags and discarding old ones, especially over a week old, so not reusing fluid. And then the last discussion around pre-anesthetic testing they want to talk about is a consideration to allow detection of underlying disorders. The decision regarding when to perform pre-anesthetic tests and which tests to include is a decision that needs to be addressed individually by each practice. There is considerable debate right now as to the extent and timing of such testing. Blood samples should be drawn prior to pre-medication because that can affect the test results. So in general, my basis of it, if I had a young, healthy animal, puppy, kitten, middle age, no underlying health conditions, I wasn't too concerned about pre-anesthetic testing. But when we're looking at our senior animals, we're looking at our cats from the age of 9 and on, and our older dogs from the ages of 7 on, or animals with underlying health conditions, then I was more in favor of pre-anesthetic testing. So there, in a bit of a complicated nutshell, is some of the information I think that you should be aware of with anesthesia and your dog or your cat. I'm hoping some of it will help you and give you a better sense. There is a lot that goes on with anesthesia. Unfortunately, in practice, it's busy. We sort of fall back on what we've always done, and we don't always sort of incorporate all those variety of suggestions. If you've got at all an older animal, an animal that's sicker in any way, I encourage you to go to that veterinary site called VASG.org. You can read about anesthetic protocols, and in particular, if you've got a diabetic cat, or if you have a dog with heart disease, you know, look at what they're suggesting for protocols and print those off, bring those to your clinic. You'd be surprised if you've taken the time to go to that site to read about that information, especially with your dog, your cat, if they've got an underlying medical disorder. Most of the time, those clinics are going to take note because they know that you're watching and you're sort of on it. So I encourage you to do it. The site again is VASG.org. So the next part of today's podcast, I want to have a little brief discussion about a new movie that's recently come out called Give Me Shelter. It's an animal welfare documentary. I myself, I've spent my whole life working in veterinary practice. You know, I worked in animals. I grew up on a farm. I worked in pet stores. I volunteered in veterinary clinic. In university, I worked with animals. I thought I had a pretty good sense about animal welfare, and I've been fairly current. But, you know, this is a movie itself, a documentary, which sort of really even opened my eyes. And it's one I think it's going to open a number of different people's eyes. It uncovers a side of the human pet industry that, you know, is sort of that unscrupulous one, largely unknown to most people in the pet world. I mean, it reveals the inhumane treatment of domestic and wild animals as they are commercialized and exploited for food, clothing, medicines, and other things. Unfortunately, it speaks to about us, our somewhat selfish species and our selfish instinct. It conveys just how we continue to dominate rather than coexist. It's a reminder of what we have done and continue to do to the voiceless. It's engaging, unprecedented. It's enlightening as it is disturbing. Captures this sort of sad reality through interviews with noted celebrity animal activists and professional advocates. It conveys something about our own sentience or lack thereof and our disregard for many members of the animal kingdom. Despite how progressive we may perceive our society to be, this documentary clearly establishes just how far we need to go. I mean, it takes us on this journey of young dogs and cats from commercial puppy mills and catteries to pet retail stores around the nation. It reveals the horrific nature of the horse slaughter industry and the brutal last days of many of our pet, our horses. The film also exposes the brutality on fur farms and factory food animal farms. It explores the lives of performing animals. It exposes the dangerous and irresponsible trade in exotic animals in the United States. It broaches the subject of conservation and the plight of threatened and endangered species around the world. No question, it's a must-see. It's now available on Netflix. You can stream it on it, so just search for Give Me Shelter. It's available for sale on Amazon, and all proceeds are going in support of animal welfare. So once again, the name of that documentary, it's called Give Me Shelter, and you can actually just type in Give Me Shelter animal movie and come up. And as I said, you're also going to see it on, you can stream it on Netflix if you have Netflix, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon. So the last section of the podcast, I had a listener actually wrote in and had a question around convenience. An injectable antibiotic, it's seen within many clinics and veterinarians as sort of this wonder antibiotic, because you can give it once and you've treated the infection. You don't have to keep coming back in and giving your especially your fractious cat something, or your dog, one shot and that's it. It's labeled for the treatment of skin infections in cats and dogs. It exerts its antibacterial effects for approximately 1 to 2 weeks, but it stays in the body for over 2 months. This is in contrast to antibiotics that are rapidly cleared from the body, and which need to be administered 1 to 2 times a day. And given how difficult it is to medicate some animals, specifically cats, I mean, doesn't it sound great? But in many cases, you know, that old adage, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, rings true with respect to convenience. Most people are aware of the fact that all drugs have potential side effects, with some being more significant or life-threatening than others. So we need to be mindful of these side effects when any chemical is put into a living being, not just convenience. That said, with regard to convenience, it's important to consider the fact that if a patient has an adverse reaction to convenience, there is no way to retrieve this long-acting drug from their body. If an adverse reaction occurs after a short-acting drug is administered, the patient, the dog or cat, has a much greater chance of living through this event, because the body will clear the offending drug, hopefully within hours, not months, as in the case with convenience. So this is what you need to know, and this is what is stated on the convenience drug insert. 1. Anaphylaxis has been reported with use of this product in foreign market experience. If an allergic reaction or anaphylaxis occurs, convenia should not be administered again, and appropriate therapy should be instituted. Anaphylaxis may require treatment with epinephrine and other emergency measures, including oxygen, intravenous fluids, intravenous antihistamine, corticosteroids, and airway management, as clinically indicated. Adverse reactions may require prolonged treatment due to the prolonged systemic drug clearance, which is 65 days within your animal. In foreign market experience, the following adverse events were reported voluntarily during post-approval use of the product in dogs and cats in foreign market: death, tremors, ataxia, seizures, anaphylaxis, acute pulmonary edema, facial edema, injection site reactions, hair loss, scabs, skin loss, necrosis, and erythema, hemolytic anemia, salivation, pruritus, lethargy, vomiting and diarrhea, and inappetence. The most common reactions amongst veterinarians are anemia, so that's low blood cell count, tremors, ataxia, seizures, diarrhea, lethargy, anorexia, and death. Yes, all drugs have side effects. Convenia, in my own opinion, is one which it does have a side effect. There's nothing. It can be so serious, and you can't just remove that drug. The result meaning it'd be just so much more serious for your dog or cat. And there's many other safe choices in most cases, even ones where we claim that, you know, it's an animal that can't be pilled or can't be treated. You have many other options. So in my opinion, I would never give it in practice. I would never use it, never give it to my own dogs or cats. So thanks for listening to today's podcast. I hope you got some good information today. I hope you have a better sense of how to provide anesthesia for your dog or cat, and how to make it safe in terms of, you know, what to expect, what to expect from anesthesia at your clinic, questions that you can ask. You know, I give you a list of different points and the site you can go to and look at, you know, what would be the best if you've got a sicker dog or cat, an older dog or cat, a pet that has some form of system compromise. Go to the site vasg.org and be aware of some of the more safer anesthetic protocols. I encourage you to check out the movie. It's called Gimme Shelter. You can search it on Netflix now and stream it and watch it. Purchase a copy on Amazon. It's a wonderful, wonderful movie in support of animal welfare. Then lastly, I hope you've found a bit of that information about convenient enlightening and the reasons why I don't think you should be using it for your dog or cat. But once again, thanks for listening. If you have any questions or concerns, I'd love to hear them. I'm putting all the podcasts up on my blog. It's at veterinarysecrets.com/blog, and just leave a comment after, you know, this podcast, or else you can send me an email, and that's at podcast@veterinarysecrets.com. Once again, thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next week. This is Dr. Andrew Jones.